Chapter 28. 21 years and 6 months do not pass without setting a mark even upon durable stone and triple brass. Upon humanity such a period works nothing less than transformation. In Barnett's old birthplace, vivacious young children with bones like india rubber had grown up to be stable men and women. Men and women had dried in the skin, stiffened, withered, and sunk into decrepitude. While selections from every class had been consigned to the outlying cemetery. Of inorganic differences, the greatest was that a railway had invaded the town, tying it onto a main line at a junction a dozen miles off. Barnett's house on the Harbor Road, once so insistently new, had acquired a respectable mellowness, with ivy, Virginia creepers, lichens, damp patches, and even constitutional infirmities of its own like its elder fellows. Its architecture, once so very improved and modern, had already become stale in style, without having reached the dignity of being old-fashioned. Trees about the Harbor Road had increased in circumference or disappeared under the saw, while the church had had such a tremendous practical joke played upon it by some facetious restorer or other, as to be scarce recognizable by its dearest old friends. During this long interval, George Barnett had never once been seen or heard of in the town of his fathers. It was the evening of a market day, and some half-dozen middle-aged farmers and dairymen were lounging round the bar of the Black Bull Hotel, occasionally dropping a remark to each other, and less frequently to the two barmaids who stood within the pewter-topped counter in a perfunctory attitude of attention, these latter sighing and making a private observation to one another at odd intervals, on more interesting experiences than the present. "Days get shorter," said one of the dairymen, as he looked towards the street, and noticed that the lamplighter was passing by. The farmers merely acknowledged by their countenances the propriety of this remark, and finding that nobody else spoke, one of the barmaids said "yes," in a tone of painful duty. "Come fair day we shall have to light up before we start for home along." "That's true," his neighbor conceded, with a gaze of blankness. "And after that we shan't see much further difference all's winter." The rest were not unwilling to go, even so far as this. The barmaid sighed again, and raised one of her hands from the counter on which they rested to scratch the smallest surface of her face with the smallest of her fingers. She looked towards the door, and presently remarked, "I think I hear the bus coming in from station." The eyes of the dairymen and farmers turned to the glass door dividing the hall from the porch, and in a minute or two the omnibus drew up outside. Then there was a lumbering down of luggage, and then a man came into the hall, followed by a porter with a portmanteau on his pole, which he deposited on a bench. The stranger was an elderly person, with curlyish and white hair, a deeply creviced outer corner to each eyelid, and a countenance baked by innumerable suns to the color of terracotta, its hue and that of his hair contrasting like heat and cold respectively. He walked meditatively and gently, like one who was fearful of disturbing his own mental equilibrium. But whatever lay at the bottom of his breast had evidently made him so accustomed to its situation there that it caused him little practical inconvenience. He paused in silence while, with his dubious eyes fixed on the barmaids, he seemed to consider himself. In a moment or two he addressed them and asked to be accommodated for the night. As he waited he looked curiously round the hall, but said nothing. As soon as invited he disappeared up the staircase, preceded by a chambermaid and candle, and followed by a lad with his trunk. Not a soul had recognized him. A quarter of an hour later, when the farmers and dairymen had driven off to their homesteads in the country, he came downstairs, took a biscuit and one glass of wine, and walked out into the town, where the radiance from the shop windows had grown, so in volume of late years, as to flood with cheerfulness every standing cart, barrow, stall, and idler that occupied the wayside, whether shabby or genteel. His chief interest at present seemed to lie in the names painted over the shop fronts and on doorways. As far as they were visible, these now differed to an ominous extent from what they had been 20 years before. The traveler passed on till he came to the bookseller's, where he looked in through the glass door. A fresh-faced young man was standing behind the counter, otherwise the shop was empty. The gray-haired observer entered, asked for some periodical by way of paying for admission, and with his elbow on the counter, began to turn over the pages he had bought, though that he read nothing was obvious. At length he said, "Is old Mr. Watkins still alive?" In a voice which had a curious youthful cadence in it even now. "My father is dead, sir," said the young man. "Ah, I am sorry to hear it," said the stranger. "But it is so many years since I last visited this town that I could hardly expect it should be otherwise." After a short silence he continued, "And is the firm of Barnett, Browse, and Company still in existence? They used to be large flax merchants and twine spinners here?" "The firm is still going on, sir, but they have dropped the name of Barnett. I believe that was a sort of fancy name at least. I never knew of any living Barnett. 'Tis now Browse and Company." "And does Andrew Jones still keep on as architect?"
"He's dead, sir."
"And the vicar of St. Mary's, Mr. Melrose?"
"He's been dead a great many years."
"Dear me."
He paused yet longer and cleared his voice. "Is Mr. Down, the solicitor, still in practice?"
"No, sir, he's dead. He died about 7 years ago."
Here it was a longer silence still, and an attentive observer would have noticed that the paper in the stranger's hand increased its imperceptible tremor to a visible shake. That gray-haired gentleman noticed it himself, and rested the paper on the counter. "Is Mrs. Down still alive?"
He asked, closing his lips firmly as soon as the words were out of his mouth, and dropping his eyes.
"Yes, sir, she's alive and well. She's living at the old place."
"In East Street?"
"Oh no, at Chateau Ringdale. I believe it has been in the family for some generations."
"She lives with her children, perhaps?"
"No, she has no children of her own. There were some Miss Downs. I think they were Mr. Down's daughters by a former wife, but they are married and living in other parts of the town.
Mrs. Down lives alone."
"Quite alone?"
"Yes, sir, quite alone."
The newly arrived gentleman went back to the hotel and dined, after which he made some change in his dress, shaved back his beard to the fashion that had prevailed 20 years earlier when he was young and interesting, and once more emerging, bent his steps in the direction of the Harbor Road. Just before getting to the point where the pavement ceased and the houses isolated themselves, he overtook a shambling, stooping, unshaven man, who at first sight appeared like a professional tramp, his shoulders having a perceptible greasiness as they passed under the gaslight. Each pedestrian momentarily turned and regarded the other, and the tramp-like gentleman started back.
"Good, why is that Mr. Barnett?"
"'Tis Mr. Barnett, surely."
"Yes, and you are Charlson?"
"Yes, I you notice my appearance. The fates have rather ill-used me. By the by, that £50. I never paid it, did I? But I was not ungrateful."
Here the stooping man laid one hand emphatically on the palm of the other.
"I gave you a chance, Mr. George Barnett, which many men would have thought full value received the chance to marry your Lucy. As far as the world was concerned, your wife was a drowned woman, hey?"
"Heaven forbid all that, Charlson."
"Well, was a wrong way of showing gratitude, I suppose. And now a drop of something to drink for old acquaintance sake. And Mr. Barnett, she's again free, there's a chance now, if you care for it, ...... and the speaker pushed his tongue into his hollow cheek, and slanted his eye in the old fashion. I know all, said Barnett quickly, and slipping a small present into the hands of the needy, saddening man, he stepped ahead, and was soon in the outskirts of the town. He reached the harbor road, and paused before the entrance to a well-known house. It was so highly bosomed in trees and shrubs planted since the erection of the building, that one would scarcely have recognized the spot as that which had been a mere neglected slope till chosen as a site for a dwelling. He opened the swing gate, closed it noiselessly, and gently moved into the semicircular drive, which remained exactly as it had been marked out by Barnett on the morning when Lucy Saville ran in, to thank him for procuring her the post of governess to Down's children. But the growth of trees and bushes which revealed itself at every step was beyond all expectation. Sun-proof and moon-proof bowers vaulted the walks, and the walls of the house were uniformly bearded with creeping plants as high as the first-floor windows. After lingering for a few minutes in the dusk of the bending boughs, the visitor rang the doorbell, and on the servant appearing, he announced himself as an old friend of Mrs. Downs. The hall was lighted, but not brightly, the gas being turned low, as if visitors were rare. There was a stagnation in the dwelling. It seemed to be waiting. Could it really be waiting for him? The partitions which had been probed by Barnett's walking stick, when the mortar was green, were now quite brown with the antiquity of their varnish, and the ornamental woodwork of the staircase, which had glistened with a pale yellow newness when first erected, was now of a rich wine color. During the servant's absence, the following colloquy could be dimly heard through the nearly closed door of the drawing room. He didn't give his name. He only said, an old friend, ma'am. What kind of gentleman is he? A statish gentleman, with gray hair. The voice of the second speaker seemed to affect the listener greatly. After a pause, the lady said, very well, I will see him. And the stranger was shown in face to face with the Lucy who had once been Lucy Saville. The round cheek of that formerly young lady had, of course, alarmingly flattened its curve in her modern representative. A pervasive grayness overspread her once dark brown hair, like morning rime on heather. The parting down the middle was white and jagged. Once it had been a thin white line, a narrow crevice between two high banks of shade. But there was still enough left to form a handsome knob behind, and some curls beneath inward with a few hairs like silver wires were very becoming. In her eyes the only modification was that their originally mild rectitude of expression had become a little more stringent than heretofore. Yet she was still girlish, a girl who had been gratuitously weighted by destiny with a burden of 45 years instead of her proper 20. Lucy, don't you know me? He said, when the servant had closed the door. I knew you the instant I saw you. She returned cheerfully. I don't know why, but I always thought you would come back to your old town again. She gave him her hand, and then they sat down. They said you were dead, continued Lucy, but I never thought so. We should have heard of it for certain, if you had been. It is a very long time since we met. Yes, what you must have seen, Mr. Barnett, in all these roving years, in comparison with what I have seen in this quiet place. Her face grew more serious. You know my husband has been dead a long time. I am a lonely old woman now, considering what I have been. Though Mr. Down's daughters all married managed to keep me pretty cheerful. And I am a lonely old man, and have been any time these 20 years. But where have you kept yourself? And why did you go off so mysteriously? Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, Lucy, I have kept myself a little in America, and a little in Australia, a little in India, a little at the Cape, and so on. I have not stayed in any place for a long time, as it seems to me, and yet more than 20 years have flown. But when people get to my age, 2 years go like one. Your second question, why did I go away so mysteriously, is surely not necessary. You guessed why, didn't you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, no, I never once guessed, apostrophe, she said simply, nor did Charles, nor did anybody as far as I know. Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, indeed. Now think it over again, and then look at me, and say if you can't guess. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she looked him in the face with an inquiring smile. Surely not because of me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said, pausing at the commencement of surprise. Barnett nodded, and smiled again, but his smile was sadder than hers. Because I married Charles? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she asked. Yes, solely because you married him on the day I was free to ask you to marry me. My wife died 24 hours before you went to church with Down. The fixing of my journey at that particular moment was because of her funeral, but once away I knew I should have no inducement to come back, and took my steps accordingly. Apostrophe, apostrophe, her face assumed an aspect of gentle reflection, and she looked up and down his form with great interest in her eyes. I never thought of it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said. I knew, of course, that you had once implied some warmth of feeling towards me, but I concluded that it passed off. And I have always been under the impression that your wife was alive at the time of my marriage. Was it not stupid of me? But you... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.